to Freshly Forever, a podcast that gives you fascinating insights week after week. Here's your host, Vi Kumar.
Hey folks, welcome to another episode on Podcast Freshly Forever. Today I have the honor of talking to Dr. Maureen O'Shaughnessy. She is an expert educational consultant and MicroSchools founder, book author, and a TEDx speaker. She founded LeadPrep, an innovative micro school where education is engaging, not one size fits all, so learners can be seen, heard, valued, and can thrive. Hello, Maureen. How are you? Welcome to the show.
Hi, Vi. It's so great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, absolutely. I thought it's very, very significant in the present day scenario to talk about what students go through and how we can help them be successful. And so if we can start with the current stage or scenario in the education landscape, whether it's student-centric, teacher-centric, or overall, you know, like, is it like a happy medium where there's, you know, it's like a success-oriented system? I think that would be great. The listeners can benefit from your insights there.
Absolutely. So a cool part about being a school leader for, yikes, almost 30 years is I have seen a lot of progressions. And right now, we're at an amazing time in history. It's actually kind of a collision. Traditional kind of assembly line, you sit for this many minutes, you take these classes, has clashed, and the pandemic has been the source of this, and it's giving us a great opportunity to look at why we do what we do, look at equity through a different lens. And as we're gaining awareness on different racial issues and other pieces, we are unpacking schools for the first time in a long time, and it has some really exciting possibilities.
Okay. Are we focusing on what students may be interested in, really, or are we do we delve into a common theme, you think?
So it depends on the school and the program. I think that public schools have been handcuffed a bit by having to teach to state tests, and that governments and businesses have said state testing gives us a way that we can measure, but that we're going, wait, this is making kids test ready, not future ready. So everybody in the public school realm is rethinking that. I'm fortunate to be in a private micro school, and we are very student-based. We have passion projects. We have mini courses. We have kids doing project-based learning. And there are other schools out there doing that. Big Picture Learning is doing that in public schools around the U.S. P-Tech is doing school to work and giving kids paid internships. So there are glimmers of students being empowered and some traditional kids going through the motion.
But is it nurturing student confidence at all and the ability to have, like, say, a discussion-oriented classroom? Or do you think for them to, say, ask questions, can they just derive more from it than just eliciting some answers? You know, like, can they just, you know, how are we playing into student confidence there?
I think that some teachers are saying, okay, what's the answer to problem 7? And they want a textbook answer. But I think a lot more teachers are saying, guys, what makes sense to you? Or how can we do this together? Or what would you like to create to make this real world and relevant to you? So I think more and more teachers, especially during the pandemic, where we're aware that it's not business as usual, are asking, how are you? What can we do together? And starting to change the questions. And there have been some great teachers along the way that have been very Socratic and had wonderful open conversations and dialogues. But I think it's pivoting and more people are putting humans before memorization and content right now.
But when you say, you know, those wonderful teachers already, you know, like probably those are the ones that you get to hear more at the dinner table, right? You know, like when you tend to hear frequently those names being mentioned in the conversation.
Exactly. You know? Kids, when they are seen and heard and valued, that connection is what they take to the dinner table. It's like, oh, my teacher let me do this, or did you know? That's when there's the enthusiasm, when it feels real and it feels connected versus something external and hoops that kids just need to go through to get to the other end.
But are we in like a one size fits all approach, you think, currently? And is that even working? And why is it that you started your micro school? And tell us more about it, you know, like about this one size fits all approach. I mean, like, what are we even doing?
Absolutely. Yes. We are still in the industrial era, by and large, in our school systems, that every kid will take 4 years of high school English, 3 years of this, an assembly line approach to widgets. And I raised my girls overseas and I brought them back to the US for high school. And we tried 6 or 7 different models, could not find the right fit. I just helped them graduate early. And then I decided I want to honor that our kids are not widgets. My 2 daughters were not widgets. Uh-huh. And actually that this is kind of the norm. So I created a micro school and then I wrote a guidebook. So I wrote a guidebook so others could create a micro school or a school within a school. And the whole first third of the book is talking about our outliers, you know, all of these different profiles of learners. And kids feel like I'm the only one that is bored and gifted and already knows this. I'm the only one with autism, or I'm the only one dealing with gender and identity pieces. And actually, these outliers are the majority of our students. And so if we can say, wait, we are not one size fits all. We are not widgets. Our kids are precious, this rainbow, and we call them mismatched socks. They are not all white gym socks. They're beautiful stripes and polka dots. Uh-huh. Then our education system needs to honor their strengths, how they learn, their interests, tie into passions so that it's relevant and meaningful. None of us want to do stuff. I do my tax return because I have to, but it gives me no joy. But if I get to do art, or if I get to do something that's helping others, I light up. So the more we can help kids light up and learn their strengths and play to their passions, the more education is relevant and powerful. So that assembly line needs to change to student-driven and human-centered and learning 24/7 and in the communities and everywhere. And people are nudging hard enough. I think we're getting a critical mass to say the assembly line does not serve our teachers, our students, our communities, our world.
Uh-huh. And it's interesting you brought up that you raised your children overseas. And there was a kid that, or she's actually a young adult now, who I happened to talk to at our dinner table. It was interesting. She mentioned in her system, she had not done English in her high school, or, you know, like the way that system was, you know, it just didn't require her to be writing essays and all of that. And then when she had to apply to colleges here, or when she had to, you know, like do her core classes in college here, she had to start doing it all over again. And certain things seemed like kind of out of whack, out of line for her. So it's interesting that you bring that up, and the need to, you know, like make it kind of passion oriented and focus on a human centric approach. What about your alignment with any public schools in any form or means? Is it like, you know, are you like, is your micro school concept, you know, totally separate? And so how do you kind of go toe-to-toe with the public school system?
So a micro school can be a school within a school. And in fact, the first micro school I created was as a teacher in a school of 2,000 students. And I got 4 other teachers on board, and we created our own school that was very hands-on and interdisciplinary. And then a period a day, the kids could go out and do Spanish or theater. They could do other classes that we didn't offer. So It can be a feature. It can be a wraparound where you keep your third graders and you have them again in fourth grade. So you develop relationships. So creating these smaller communities where kids are really seen, heard, and valued can happen in any setting. We do not have to follow public school laws in the same way. We don't have to do state testing. We have some other freedoms. We don't have to have everybody teacher certified. So if somebody is amazing with a bachelor's degree, or we had a doctor, an MD, teaching math 1 year and didn't have to have a teacher certificate. So we have a few different guidelines. That said, we have 3 school districts that have sent a child to us, and are funding that child's tuition. So in those cases, we are aligning with public school requirements, and we always align with Washington State graduation requirements. So our kids get a high school diploma. So it's kind of a both and scenario.
Okay. So you are in Seattle, is that right?
Right.
Okay. And so is this like a K through 12 program, or are you focusing only on upperclassmen?
So I started out as a high school because that's where I saw so many kids just feeling unmotivated and like no relevance. And then we had some families say, hey, I have a little brother or a little sister that wants to be at Lead Prep. So we extended down, and now we're a 6th through 12th grade, multi-age and tiny, like 25 kids on each campus and 11 teachers shared between the two campuses. So we are super small and super big on relationships and community as our foundation.
Okay. So what would you say if we were to nail down some differentiating aspects of your program? So would you say is it it's no homework, it's more project-based, but then project-based as in-school projects? How would you categorize that for an average listener?
Yeah, I definitely would say we are project-based and we're student-learner-centered. So teachers are not lecturing and dispensing wisdom. They might have a mini lesson in a key concept, and then the kids are unpacking and experiencing it. Or they might have some guidelines. If you're doing a passion-based project, first you need to create a proposal. And using design thinking, they might have outlined the steps a student needs to take. But the teachers are really guides. Okay, where are you on this? What next? What's working? How can I help you? As opposed to I'm the expert and I have knowledge that I'm dispensing and I have certain tasks that all of you in this whole class must do identically, like chapter 7's chapter test. So it's not us dispensing the structures and the rules. It's us providing guidance and supports so that kids can unpack their learning themselves. So definitely project-based. We don't see relevance in lots of memorization at home. Sometimes if a kid needs more time, they'll take stuff home and work on it. Uh-huh. But we're not, we really want a work-life balance, and we want kids to be taking good care of themselves. So hours of homework and memorization doesn't seem to have a long-term gain, and not every culture benefits that and calls that rigor. So we don't ascribe to homework. We really want to be the guides in the school day. And if something's not working, we want to be able to coach the kid and not have them go home and practice something incorrectly because they didn't have any guidance.
Okay. What about textbooks? For someone that says, hey, do you follow a textbook? Then do you teach physics or do you do math? Do you do English? Because they heard you say that you do follow the graduation requirements as mandated by the state, correct? So, what would you say to that, Maureen?
So even back when I started school within a school in a large high school, there were multiple ways kids could get their English requirement. They could be doing drama. They could be doing speech. They could be doing so many things to get English. So it's never been every kid in the state has to read Romeo and Juliet in 9th grade. There's always been flexibility. So yes, our kids do get English, but they're doing a lot of their writing and research around their passion projects. And we're working on skill development in context and in an interdisciplinary manner versus a discrete, here's your hour of English, here's this, this. And then we have some electives, some mini courses, some offerings. And some kids say, yeah, I want to be in the book group. But others are like, no, I want to do some cooking, or I want to be in leadership and planning our school events. So they have a say in where they do deeper dives. In terms of textbooks, we don't have any. We do have a progression for math, and we do use a curriculum for math because that's so personal and it's so sequential that we don't want it just to be project-based where kids might be missing some really key foundational pieces they need to progress through the algebra sequence.
So how different is this from, say, like a talented and gifted program? I mean, that's what it's called here in my county where I live here in Georgia. And my kid happened to be part of that when she was in public schools. So would you categorize that or, I mean, this program to be very similar to something like what public schools do in that setup?
Yes. sometimes. So some of our students are kids that were really frustrated. They were in honors classes where they were, but sometimes honors means hours of homework, and it just means heaping on more work. So ours is definitely more of that Montessori or that creative gifting program where kids get to make decisions and use design thinking and build and create, as opposed to we're going to give you college quantities and college content to digest in a traditional manner.
So as far as assessment, then what happens? How do you even... I guess we are in this achievement culture, immersed in it. And I know you're not a proponent of it, and neither am I a fan of. But how would you do the assessment part?
So in the world of education, there are two kinds of assessment. One is formative, and that's walking around and saying, whoa, you've got this. You want to move on? Or, whoa, I think you're missing a piece here. Let's back up. And I know you're in high school, but let's go ahead and do a long division problem and remember how remainders work. So formative is in the moment, looking at what is needed and letting it inform our next steps so that kids aren't held to, like, keep moving forward even though you've mastered this, or drag you forward even though you need more time on this. Summative is easier to do when I have five classes of 30 students each. Formative is impossible, but I can do a summary assessment at the end, your semester exam, and it sums up the learning. It sums up what you were able to demonstrate at the end of something. The problem with that, some people that aren't fans of summative assessments call them post-mortems. You're dead. The class is over. It's after, you know, it's checking things out with no chance to say, whoa, you missed this. Let's fill this in. Sometimes the kids don't even see the results to see what they knew or didn't know. So it's kind of an after the fact piece that results in this number or this letter that results in whether you have achieved or not, but it's not very meaningful or powerful. And it also creates a lot of stress. I may have demonstrated the whole semester that I knew it and I could apply it, but now I have to be able to produce in this 2-hour block on this test and everything. This is all that matters for AP or IB or for my semester exam, that I was doing a wonderful job throughout the semester doesn't matter. And that produces a lot of test anxiety and performance anxiety, and is really sad because it does not accurately demonstrate what a lot of kids know.
So true. But then colleges look at AP, colleges look at IB. So again, as far as college readiness, how do you think your students are prepared to face that situation?
So I have two different answers to that. Colleges also look at homeschool kids that have never taken a test in their lives and go, wow, this kid found a need in the community and then went out and built tree houses and all these foster homes. Oh my gosh, this kid is a doer and a processor. I want this kid. I don't have any AP, IB, class placement, you know, any of that data, but I want this kid. So colleges are impressed by kids that are out there using skills and making a difference. Also, we do ask our 11th and 12th graders to, if they're thinking 4-year college after high school or even 2-year college, to take a college placement test and then to take a college class. We have a dual enrollment program in Washington State where you can take college classes in high school. And we ask them to do like at least a math or an English 101 with our guidance. So they do an online so that they understand the pace. And that if a professor assigns it, it may not get mentioned again. And then it was due. And midnight means cutoff time. It's not like, oh, can I turn in a day or two late? And they also learn how to engage with their professors and meet them and make a point of knowing them as humans before they have any questions or concerns. So then if they do have something, they have that connection. So we do rehearse college with our students. But colleges are also super happy with kids that demonstrate skills other than memorizing and passing advanced tests.
Sure enough. And so the answer, as I hear, the answer to that is yes, kids from your micro schools have been successfully placed into colleges.
Correct.
And they are doing great. Awesome. You want to save yourself that trip to the grocery store? Instacart highlights deals to help you save money. You can get products you love from your local stores or last-minute holiday gifts delivered to you in as little as 1 hour. To avail exciting promotions, check the show notes and click the link to shop Instacart. Multiple stores available. Shop all of your favorites on a single order today with Instacart. And you brought up the aspect of online learning with them doing the dual enrollment and stuff. Of course, we have all been in this pandemic world and we still are hearing about new variants. And so the learning environment, so today's educational landscape, do you think it has helped students? Has it hindered their progress? Some think that way, some think they need to be in a face-to-face classroom. How do you think we are right now? And could we say, no, it's been a blessing in disguise for some, because some kids like the peace and quiet. They like the comfort of maybe sleeping in late and then, you know, starting with their school rather than having to rush to the bus in the morning.
So just like we've said that our kids are not widgets and one size does not fit all, the pandemic has impacted our kids in a variety of ways. We have some kids that when it went fully remote were like, yes, I'm an introvert. I can turn off my sound. I can focus. I don't have all of this, you know, chatter and this and that and movement. Uh-huh. Or kids that are feeling like, I don't like some of the social dynamics. And now I don't have these cliques of high school girls looking at what am I wearing? How am I? You know, so I'm liberated from some pieces of being in person that didn't work for me. So some mm-hmm. kids love that. Other kids are like, that social piece is the only reason I went to school. I wanted to uh-huh. see my drama peeps or my volleyball peeps. And now I just have this screen. We have kids that needed more structure and that were home alone. And when they were stuck, you know, it's like my camera's off because I have bedhead and I'm in my bedroom and the teacher has no way of knowing I'm stuck. You know what? I'm just going to go eat something and take a nap. So uh-huh. we had kids having so many different experiences. And mental health, teen mental health was a huge issue before the pandemic. And I feel like it's a crisis that we are not addressing. And the pandemic has added so much anxiety and parents working at home and kids working at home and Wi-Fi not working and what's going on? And am I going to be future ready? And will I ever be back to a regular world? Who's going to get sick and die? So I just feel like for us to try this year to say, oh, okay, people are vaccinated and go back to school and pretend like nothing has happened when kids were already having a lot of anxiety and depression pre-pandemic, for us not to address mental health is just a disgrace and a shame. We're not looking at our precious youth as humans. We're looking at them as these computers that need to memorize content if we're not addressing their emotional needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why is mental health issues so predominant? You think it's from this achievement culture, or is it peer pressure? Is it from, you know, like other bullying aspects, you know, like personality issues? What do you think is the most crucial aspect to tackling that piece of mental health?
I would say yes, yes, yes. Yes to your list. And mm-hmm. again, it depends on the kid. For that kid that's on social media a lot, to see all of these images where people are putting on their best and filtering out and having and hearing successes and maybe even made up successes is like, oh my gosh, I can never compare. I can never compete. Or I didn't get 500 likes, so I must be a zero. So for some people, it's social pressures. For others, it's like, I don't care about this. And what's this going to mean for my life? And what, I'm going to have to take more school and be in debt forever and have a desk job to pay off my debt? Uh-huh. What's the future hold for me? I don't hear any of my 20-something friends feeling like they can buy a home and do the things that their parents got to do. They're depressed and I want to leave high school and go out into that world. And others just like, I feel sad. I feel alone. I think I might want to harm myself. and who's there that can care or help me? And how do I even address it? I'm ashamed or I'm afraid. So I think it's a lot of different reasons, and definitely the achievement culture that says, carry on, march forward, get that high school credit, stay in line to graduate, regardless the cost or regardless what's going on to the human that's producing the homework assignments.
Okay. So Maureen, that makes me think, does it require few brave parents to say, to put their hand up and say, you know what, I'm not going to care about my child's grade or what society thinks as to where he or she ends up going to college. I'm going to face the world and say, hey, I'm happy that he or she went to, okay, maybe if certain institutions are ranked 1, 2, 3 in that locality or in that state, I'm happy with he or she going to number 3 as opposed to number 1. Is that the answer to it?
I think that's a definite factor, parent expectations. And parents, I think, have this almost this wall of shame that elementary, I could talk to the other moms watching their kids doing ballet and we could compare notes and what are you doing about this? But by high school, it's all about where is your child going to college? Well, my child's on an elite sports team.
Exactly.
And inside, because our parents are really connected at our micro school, inside parents are like, oh my God, is your kid shutting himself into his room a lot? And do you know what he's doing on social media and what algorithms? Is your child doing any self-harm or any cutting? And how are your child's eating habits? Are they binging, purging? How do we navigate this? You don't hear parents getting that support. So they're trying to put on a good front and pretend like everything is fine. And then they want to project that, hey, let's get you into college. Let's do this. And so they're trying to live up to what they think a good parent is doing. And the poor child isn't getting to be real or heard a lot of the time. So I do think parents need to say, forget this. My kid's well-being comes first. And you know what? A gap year is fine. A fifth year of high school is fine. My child's wellness comes first. Or we'll get something that's online and spread out and this or that and not do traditional high school. We'll look at private school options and scholarships. But my kid's well-being is far more important than going through these hoops. And maybe I'll get together with some other parents and we'll demand more from our school district, or we'll support an option, or we'll create an option, because we have too many kids falling through the cracks and our child's time is finite in this K-12 model. So we're going to get on it now and be that change that our child deserves.
I think so too. I think it just calls for some parents to speak up and say, hey, you know, I give up that shame factor. And yes, I think that's paramount. And it's interesting, you talked about structure for some kids when we talked about this pandemic world and the online schooling and everything. Is your micro school concept meant for any and every kid? Or would you say that it may not be ideal for certain types of kids?
Absolutely. We ask our students to come and visit, potential students to visit for a day. And some are like, oh, the teacher stopped and we had a conversation. It was amazing. I feel the relationship piece. And we have other kids, high school kids coming from a public 10th grade going, this is the whole school and there's 11-year-olds here and 18-year-old here. Heck no. So it really has to be a good fit, and kids need to come knowing what they're looking for. I want smaller, or I want to get it to go at my own pace, or I want to be on varsity volleyball. They need to know what they value and find the right fit. So it's really about having a lot of options available for our kids, not that a micro school is the solution or a big comprehensive high school is the solution. It's about having so many more options. And back to that parent piece, parents, how can you and your businesses make a difference? Are you that bike shop that would actually be able to help start a micro school and have kids learning how to fix bikes? And there is one in Colorado. They fix the bikes. They learn the business aspects. They get their English and math through that. And it's because the spike owner is saying, yeah, I believe in this. Let's create this. How can you help create things that are super cool? Could Google have an 11th and 12th grade where kids are doing paid internships and taking some of these college classes to finish high school and learning, you know, what would it be to work at Google? And Google's maybe training some kids up to be their future workforce. So parents, how can you create some of these options, not just demand them?
Mm-hmm. That's where I think it's not a one size fits all approach. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's where we can emphasize on that aspect that it's not one size fits all. And people have to just be able to embrace that fact and move on, right?
Back in a moment with our guest on Fresh Leaf Forever.
Your book, just to segue into that, Creating Micro Schools for Our Colorful Mismatched Kids, you take us through several parts of it. Part one is the current system, you said, and part two is the 7-step process, and part three is how you created your 3 micro schools. Is that correct?
Right. Basically, the third one, and using those 7 steps, talking through our examples, because that's the most current one that I've created.
Mm-hmm. So what about the 7-step process? If you can give listeners like an overview of, you know, like what you kind of try to say, I think, you know, that'll be interesting to hear.
Yeah. It's not linear. And so I don't even have them memorized, but they're really important considerations. I start with beginning with a mission. Are you trying to be that wraparound micro school that keeps your kids for 3 years of elementary? So it's really communal and brings in a new group, you know, maybe you're a third, fourth, fifth, and brings in a new third and launches the fifth graders to middle school. But you have this community and this long-term relationship. Are you trying to be a STEM-based, project-based middle school? You know, what are you trying to be, a flipped learning humanities program? You know, what's your mission? What are you about? Because we can't be all things to all people. And if we can be super clear, then kids can move toward that particular program if that appeals. The second is you can't go it alone. It's exhausting. So you have to recruit others that are energized and willing to be trailblazers. Mm-hmm. And often that means if it's an educator that's super into, I want to create this curriculum, you might want to get somebody on your team that's business minded. And how will we deal with the revenues or the facilities? So you have the synergy of others. The third is engaging community collaborators. So will the church loan you their space or rent you their space, because they use it on the weekends and you could use it on weekdays? We had our first year on our Seattle campus, we were in a pocket theater, and the theater used it evenings and weekends and let us use this bright red lobby on school days. You know, so how do we collaborate with the community? And we'd go up the street and work at a recycling place that had all this amazing arts and crafts stuff. So how can you collaborate with your community? The fourth is we've got to get the word out. And you know the power of social media, and you got to let people know about it so that it can grow and so you can attract in the resources you need. Fifth, choose what makes your school special. Ours, one feature is right now we have a 1-to-5 student-teacher ratio. Kids are really known. And when they are seen, heard, valued, it means they can be thriving. That's a special feature of ours. It's not that we have a swim team and a swim pool, you know, in our rec center. You know, so figure out what's special about yours. Ours is that there's agency and it's self-paced and it's competency-based. So figure out what's special about yours. Is yours, there's a choice school, a micro school in our Kirkland school district that if you take it's a Latin-based middle school. And if you take 3 years of Latin and come back and do a Saturday school in 9th grade, you get to go to Italy. You know, so that's their mission, what makes their school special. And then step 6, you got to be clear and creative on resources. What are you going to provide? What do you need? And then expect it to come in really unexpected ways. And then 7, you just have to open your door. Yeah, it may not be perfect. It may feel like a beta test. I talked to somebody that had started a school in the 90s in Seattle. He said, expect it to be 10 years to kind of feel like you're solid. And I was appalled, but we're in year nine. And it's like, I see what he was saying. There's so many phases to go through. So those are the seven steps. And then I go through how Lead Prep did those. And I share in the worksheet some of the things, you know, what we came up with for our mission statement, you know, how we set up our revenues and expense sheets and whatnot.
Are you able to even follow like a hybrid model of, say, kids want to be online some days and then kids want to come in? Or do you think it works best when they all, you know, like come in and physically be there for this concept to, you know, work at its maximum, you know, like efficacy?
You know, for us, we haven't use the hybrid model. The relationship piece and being in person and guiding kids and seeing what they're working on. And we have a neurodiverse population and some kids way ahead, some kids doing college. It really helps us. And it also plays to our strength of cross-age mentoring and positive peer influence being in person. So we ask kids to be at our school all day, every day. Where some schools you might pop in, just take an English and pop back out, and that provides a different need. So we don't do the hybrid, and we did a little bit during the pandemic before there were vaccinations because we had to be so far apart and windows open. So we'd have half the kids one day and the other half online and switch so we could spread them out and use double the space. But that meant the teacher that was doing a high school English project, instead of being in one classroom, was now spread out in two classrooms and dealing with remote kids. It was just, it was untenable. It was exhausting and grueling. So, and also there's so much unknown with kids at home with their cameras off. It's really hard to do formative assessment when we can't look over their shoulders and see, oh, wow, this is amazing. And we can't ask questions and prompt. We can't even tell if they're awake sometimes, you know, when it's remote. Yes. So hybrid for us is not a preference.
So what about, is this like an ideal setup for kids that do extracurriculars, or that's like, you know, like they are very serious about their activity outside of academic front, you know, say sports, you know, that want to become collegiate players, or, you know, any other field, for example, theater or music or whatever it may be?
Absolutely. And I say yes, but. So the but is if you're at your local school, you can be showing up for drama rehearsal. You're right there on spot and you have it built into a large comprehensive school. So you don't have that in a micro school. So if you're at a high school that's amazing, has a fantastic music program and orchestra, stay there. Or maybe you do the 0 hour jazz class and then go to a micro school. So sometimes the opportunity is right there at your big school and you want to be there to have that midday rehearsal or go to middle of the day and get your uniforms or have a lunch with your band director and talk through some things. So sometimes the comprehensive school is going to give that to you. But otherwise, to be in a school where you can play to your passions and maybe even do some projects based on what you're interested in and based on your hobbies, you can get class credit for things that you're doing outside of the school day. So if you're a gymnast, you can be looking at physiology and doing a physiology report as a part of your biology credit. And you're really caring about that because you're really focused on maximum health. And then you don't have hours of homework. So when your school day is over, you can totally focus on being that gymnast. If you have an out-of-state competition and miss a day of school, you can arrange that in advance. You can say, hey, I'll do this. I'll even film some of these pieces that tie into physiology and into our stretching program and stuff like that, and interview a couple of other gymnasts while I'm at this competition to count as my class assignment. So there's so much flexibility in playing to kids' strengths that a school like ours could be a really good fit for kids that want to leave the school day and go and compose their music and be in a band and do things other than hours of homework.
I mean, that's fantastic. And I can completely relate to whatever you're saying because I have traveled throughout my daughter's school life with her because she is a tennis player and she's still playing for her college team. And so I can completely relate to what you're saying. When it comes to accountability for teenagers, how do we teach them? And how do you think your system helps them be the best of themselves as far as being accountable? And as a parent, would you say, okay, be a buddy to your child? Is that the best way out as a parent to make your teen or tween, feel that, okay, I have the freedom in my life and I can just be, I'm able to express what I need to express to my parent. And do you think that's a good way to lead them or just find like a happy medium? What in your experience as a mother and as an educator, what is it that you would say?
So accountability is a big one. It's a balance of freedom and responsibility. And oftentimes we want more freedom, but we don't want the responsibility goes with it. I want my own car and I want to be able to go at any speed I want, but I don't want the responsibility for earning the money to pay for the gas and the insurance. So it's really about making sure that at any level of development, we understand everything has a responsibility and a freedom piece to it. And we're accountable for both. We don't just get the freedom. There's also the responsibility. I've really enjoyed taking parenting with love and logic classes. I took them when my daughters were babies, and then I took it again when they were teens. And then I offered it at my school last year, just because it really helps parents not take on the child's responsibility and like, hey, I know you'll get the dishwasher emptied so that you can head out and see your friends. And whenever you get to that, that's cool. Or, you didn't get to it and you had to go to school. So I went ahead and took $5 of your allowance because it took me 20 minutes and that's worth $5. So, so they don't fight and engage. And as a parent, I talked to other parents who were further along, and one mom said, I wish I had not made bedrooms being clean a big deal. So I'm like, oh, okay. I'm just going to say, shut your doors. What goes on in there? I don't want any food, any dishes or stuff like that. But it's your choice if that's how you want to live. Laundry is done on this day. If not, do it yourself. So we have to detach as parents and let them practice and experience and fumble with our loving help, fumble and fail forward, learning from it. And the school front, our model is really good for accountability because we're small. I don't have the same accountability when I have 150 students. It's like, turn it in or you fail. What we have at Lead Prep is get 80% or keep trying. And I can help with that. Whoa, what's not going right? How can we redo this? And we can really build that in. So kids don't get zeros at our school. They don't have a chance to opt out and say, not going to do it. I'll just take a zero. So we have that accountability built in, but they also know they get coaching and support and no penalty for retrying. Some schools I've been in, if you retake a test, you'll only get half credit the second time. And that makes it hard to be motivated to improve if I'm going to do all this work and study and get partial credit. If I'm growing and improving and learning and demonstrate that I know this, but no, you didn't do it on our timeline, so you're penalized. So there's some outdated thinking that makes it hard for kids to want to be accountable. And I think relationship-based and smaller and demanding competencies and rewarding. Oh, you already have this? Move ahead. I'm not going to drone on stuff you already know, or you don't want to do it this way? Tell me how you will demonstrate knowledge of this. Oh, you want to create a video and you want to do filming and this and that instead of writing an essay? Okay, give me the outline. Let's talk through it. But of course. So I think when we give kids agency, voice, and choice, they're much more willing to become accountable because they have buy-in and a say, and we all want a say in our lives. So why would our children be any less?
Yes, and screaming doesn't help. And I like your idea of, that $5 off of your allowance if you didn't do the, if you don't do the dishwasher, right? Something simple as that. And another guest on my show, she gave a very nice tip one time, follow like a 60 to 90 second rule where, you kind of, stop and think. So it's almost like it becomes like a mindfulness exercise. And before you right away, before you retort or before you answer right away, right, you just kind of pause. That helps you too. I've always found that to be helpful. you know, in any situation, even in adult relationships, you know, like you're not yelling at one another.
I love that. Stop and think and maybe even think in advance. What's my intention going into this? I need to address that they're not getting their homework done. What's my intention? Is it to let them know they're wrong? Is it to create a plan and to be curious? Can I have that beginner's mind? Can I be curious? The other formula that I've really enjoyed and I try to follow with my teachers, with other relationships, is at least a 2-to-1 ratio. Am I expressing appreciation and gratitude and seeing the good at least twice as much as the times I'm saying, well, you didn't get the dishwasher emptied, you didn't get the garbage taken out, you're late for class. Am I saying, oh my gosh, thank you for opening the door for that person in the grocery store. You are so kind. Am I finding positive at least twice as often as I'm critiquing? And that's just showing that we value and appreciate each other.
Mm-hmm. That's one. And also, you know, anything, even right from verbiage in everyday language, you know, it helps to use more positive than, you know, like stating the negative, right? So
yeah.
It just is, it just always, I find that, you know, it's just wonderful. And it just is more uplifting.
And it's informative.
That.
If I tell a first grader, stop running, I haven't given them any information. If I say, hey, you need to walk, I've told them what they need to do. So a lot of times I say, don't do that. Well, what do you want me to do? So if you could say, I can't focus when there's tapping, could I have you please stop that? If you tell people what you need them to do, instead of just don't or stop or quit, but
no, maybe you want to slow down. Maybe you want to slow down instead of saying stop running, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Something as simple as that can make a difference. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just wonderful. And as an expert education consultant and an educator parent, everything combined, what would you say are some paramount indicators in today's system that shows us the need to even pivot, you know, like what made you in the first place, you know, create these micro schools or, you know, or what would you say still are trends in the current education landscape that seems to indicate that we need to, you know, pivot?
Wow, there are a lot of different indicators from different stakeholder perspectives. I think one, our 7-year-old doesn't wear the same pants he wore when he was a 3-year-old. You know, they grow, they change, they need new, and our system hasn't. I don't use the same phone locked to the wall that I had in high school where, with a rotary dial. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a smartphone and does my GPS and everything. Our system is basically the same as it was 100 years ago. So people looking at systems are saying, wait, this is outdated. Just like my phone gets updated for me, it's a long time, every 4 or 5 years when I have to. But for other people, it could even be less. I think the mental health crisis, we see so many kids that are anxious and depressed and medicated and not thriving. I think that's an indicator. We hear colleges saying, kids aren't ready when they get to us. We hear businesses saying kids aren't ready when they get to us. So we hear the culture saying this generation, these millennials, they don't want to have a regular job and work 9 to 5. So we're hearing all of these disconnects and it's telling us it's not working or it's not working for enough of our kids enough of the time. It's not producing the results that colleges and the workforce want or happy, confident adults that we all wish. You know, we aspire for our kids to leave high school and be ready to use their good to serve the world. We're not getting enough of this. And that's when there's discontent. That's that grain of sand that is annoying the oyster. But if we let it be and say, yeah, this is annoying, we can create that pearl. If we know that it's a process and it's going to be hard work and gritty and uncomfortable, we can say, well, so what do we want and what are we willing to contribute to get what we want? Are we willing to let a kid have a semester off for a mental health break and go and volunteer in preschools and just love up these little kids and not think about high school requirements? What are we willing to do differently to get the different results that we want?
Yeah, I think you said it beautifully and can't emphasize that more in this forum. I mean, both you and I are podcasters, and hearing about any high school shooting is never a never a pleasant experience. I mean, it's just, my heart goes out to all those families, you know, that have been impacted in the recent high school shootings in Michigan. And, you know, it just has been very, very devastating every time something like that happens. So mental health, that seems to be the topic of prime concern. And you, in your TED talk, said, changing my mind to change our schools. And right from when you were in fourth grade, you talk about doing things not considered part of the norm. So how important is this, say, like this almost, we need to do things differently. And so if we need to do things differently, how do we kind of, you know, it almost seems like a change management approach.
I think it is. Yeah, I think it's also strength-based. And we talk about ikigai at our school, which is the Japanese idea that you have a reason for jumping out of bed in the morning. And Okinawa in Japan has the greatest longevity of lifespan in the world. And there's also a peninsula in Costa Rica that does. And it's considered to be attributed to this ikigai, that they're, you know, that what they're good at and what they really care deeply about. Like one way they say it is what breaks your heart in the world, like that the oceans have all this pollution, that sea life is dying. You know, so what breaks your heart? What do you care deeply about? What are you good at? You know, what might you be able to make some money at? You know, where, how do all your passions and strengths and skills pull together to give you that ikigai? And if we could be driven by that, and I just feel like that it's change management, but it's not just change for change's sake. It's aligning with our best and highest selves. And what am I on this planet to do? And for me, it's nothing culinary. I will invite you over, but we will probably get takeout, you know, so I know what things it
I can cook.
Isn't.
I can see, cook for you.
See, there you go. And, but that's, so it's more than change management. It's acknowledging our differences, and it's neurodiversity. It's different skills, different gifts, different interests, and letting us build and go in the direction of our strengths and our dreams, and building that up. But that is a change from every kid needs to learn these basic concepts back in a day before smartphones. Now, do I really need to know when the Civil War was, or can I just Google it on my phone? And is it more important for me to understand the themes of dissent and how we can prevent a future war from happening, and prevent colonialism and imperialism, and how is that present in our lives now? You know, so it's more than change for change's sake, and it's based on what each of us is called to be doing, and how can we bring that out and celebrate that in each other versus an us them, which was my TED talk. Sometimes I was really passionate about traditional schools are wrong and we need to do this. And it's no, it's that duality, holding that, that dialectic piece. Traditional schools do this and this and this super well and have all these wonderful extracurriculars, and non-traditional do this well. How can we take our common mission for kids to be life ready and thriving and take the good from both, deal with what we're worried about with each, and pull together toward that? So it's changing my mind from right and wrong and us and them to collaborate and to honor that duality for us to move toward common goals. So that's more of my approach.
Yeah, ensuring student success, right? You know, that's the bottom line. And that's the whole idea of this conversation on this podcast. And as a mom that raised kids in like several countries and in different education systems, Maureen, how do you think we can compare ourselves to what is out there worldwide? You know, you have been an educator outside, and you are doing something, you know, phenomenal here. But how do we think, you know, we compare ourselves to what's out there in the world? And this podcast or any podcast has the opportunity to be, you know, like reaching out to global audience. So I think that's very significant that we address that.
Absolutely. And I love what your podcast is doing, taking a fresh look at so many different topics and shining a light on different ways of seeing things. So Vaya, your work is awesome. Just want to say that.
I appreciate that.
Globally, I was in South America, Asia, Europe, Central America. I see a lot of rote memorization with teachers in the front of rows of students calling all the shots and kids passively going through the motions. So overall, I don't see a really good global trend. I would like to spend more time in Northern Europe. I think sometimes they're like, yeah, our kids don't need to read until they're 8 or 9. Let's just let them be exposed to all these languages and this and that. And then, boom, this 8-year-old is suddenly reading and writing in 3 languages because we didn't force it. And we let it really go with their developmental levels. So I think there are some cultures and countries doing things differently. But I just saw way too much rote to the point of kids. My daughter in preschool in South America was told to color in this dog, and she was given a black or a brown crayon to do it with. And I was like, okay, mom, be quiet. But part of me is like, what if she wanted a purple dog with pink polka dots, you know? And her sister in kindergarten was practicing forming letters over and over. And sure enough, those kids have beautiful penmanship. But all of this rote, you know, I feel like it could have been counterbalanced with more creativity. And Sir Ken Robinson's TED Talk is still the most listened to. And it asks us, are schools killing creativity? And sadly, it was a rhetorical question because by and large, yes, they are. And creativity could align with our highest selves and also solve a lot of the world's problems. So we're giving up on creativity at a huge cost.
Yeah, I think we all need to, you know, find a happy medium again. You know, I studied in Asia, then, you know, I came here on work and I've lived here for more than 2 decades now. And I belong here in America and I'm a citizen too. But I think I can see the positives from there. I can see the positives here. And I guess it's kind of like a secret sauce, if you will, that we need to, you know, kind of put together for both the students to thrive and for parents to kind of ensure that and for educators to play their best part. And in closing, what would you like to say to the listeners, Maureen, you know, like if for students, for parents and for educators, you know, like if you were to give your secret formula, what would that be?
I think that it's really about challenging ourselves to use our gifts and to be a force for good. And I love what the poet Mary Oliver challenged us. She had a quote and she was just asking us, what are you going to do with your one wild and precious life? What are we doing? How are we showing up? How are we giving back? And I challenge all of us to figure out what gives us light and life, and get out there and do it to make a positive difference.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on the show. I totally appreciate it. I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation and look forward to many more in the future. Thank you. Bye now.
Oh, bye. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And to listeners, thanks so much for tuning in week after week. Follow me on Instagram at YPKumar and for the podcast at Freshly Forever for constant updates. I will see you back again with yet another guest and yet another interesting topic. Until then, it's Vi saying so long.